Tonight I'm going to talk about discipline. Discipline is one of the six paramitas or six perfections attributed to the Buddha and Bodhisattvas in the Mahayana tradition. Generosity, discipline, patience, enthusiasm, concentration, and insight. And I think we all know discipline is something we would all like to have more of, you know, in some ways. I think I'll begin by saying about discipline, it's funny the time we live in. If you think about it, you know, the time we live in, the place we live in, we're inundated with choices. You know, we can go into the grocery store and, you know, I don't want this brand or this brand. I want this brand, you know, this sort of thing, you know, and we want exactly this kind of food and we want our, you know, our clothes, our living space, the music we listen to. We all want exactly this and not that. You know, we have so many choices that we can choose. You know, and even with our emotions, you know, I don't want to feel this. I want to feel that, but I don't want to feel this, you know, this sort of thing. And even our relationship with truth, you know, it's, you know, that's something, all right, that I'll accept. No, I don't want to believe that, you know. And of course, there's ways that that is even present in the political discourse, but in some ways we all do that, you know, not quite facing the truth that we don't want to face. And I think all of this makes us perhaps the most undisciplined cohort of adults that has ever walked the face of the earth, you know, just the tremendous choices we have compared to all other times or places. So we kind of start there, you know, and I think it's important to appreciate where we're starting from as we approach discipline. To talk about discipline, I want to use three analogies. And I'll say by discipline, I'm thinking primarily of spiritual disciplines. Of course, meditation is in some ways the template spiritual discipline, but, you know, of course, having a strong yoga practice, a Tai Chi practice, there's many other ways that one can have discipline, many, many different kinds of yogas in Patanjali sense. So the first analogy I'll use is a cast, say the cast that you'd have if you broke an arm. You know, and so say I broke my arm, the doctors would put a cast on my arm. And of course, a cast is kind of an artificial external support. You know, the cast itself doesn't do any healing, you know, it simply holds my arm in alignment, and then the healing happens. And of course, if I broke my arm, you know, they put it in a cast, I'd be in a cast for a few months, maybe there'd be some physical therapy, but a few years later, that arm would be essentially as good as new. It would be, again, what it was supposed to be. It would be an arm. Now, if you think back to caveman times, you know, times long before Western medicine or splints or anything, you know, if someone broke their arm in caveman times, you know, I mean, some people just die immediately of infection and that sort of thing. But if the arm healed, it would probably heal in kind of a crooked fashion. And there might be chronic pain and it would never quite be a full useful arm again, you know. And I think there's a profound analogy for discipline there. You know, meditation, like a cast, you could say is an artificial external constraint that we're putting on ourselves, you know. And from the point of view of the, you know, American sensibilities, why would we put an artificial constraint on ourselves, you know? But there's something really profound about the analogy because that constraint that we put on ourselves is actually healing. It allows us to heal into a deep alignment with ourselves, such that we become the person that we were meant to become. I think there's this, kind of almost a presupposition in American culture right now that, you know, if I just go along doing the things that I like, I'm going to become the person that I need to become, you know? And there's something naive about that. It's almost like expecting that, you know, if I break my arm, that somehow it's going to magically heal without the cast, you know, that sort of thing. The other day I was having a discussion about this phrase, people describing themselves as spiritual and not religious, you know, and in some sense, the constraint, the caste, or the practice is the religion, and the healing that takes place within it is the spirituality. You know, I see them very much connected. And so that I would say is the first, what this first analogy reveals about discipline is that even though it may seem artificial at first, and we may chafe against it because it is artificial, it's actually something that allows us to heal into a deep alignment. It allows us to get to a place where we wouldn't get without that discipline. The second analogy for discipline is the chrysalis, or the cocoon that a caterpillar creates for itself. Of course, we know caterpillar, you know, goes through life eating leaves, and at a certain point, it's time for it to make its cocoon, and it makes the chrysalis. When the caterpillar is inside the chrysalis, it entirely liquefies. It is a profound change. And if you think about, you know, the kind of body and kind of motion that a caterpillar has and the kind of body and the kind of motion that a butterfly has, it's profoundly different. And I don't know that this has been researched a whole lot, but it can't be all that comfortable to go through that process, you know? But it's the kind of thing that once it gets going, like there's no eject button, like there's no pause or rewind or anything for the caterpillar. And that, I think, points to a few powerful things about discipline. Once we start discipline, we don't really know, we can't see at the beginning where it's going to take us. We don't really understand what the end point of our growth is going to be. You know, I mean, you could say, you know, not that caterpillars are all that sentient, but you could, you know, the caterpillar would have no idea going into the process what it would mean to be a butterfly. You know, a few weeks ago when I was talking about self-improvement, I was made the radical statement, meditation is not a system of self-improvement, you know, and similarly, you know, the caterpillar doesn't enter the chrysalis to become a better caterpillar, you know, it is completely transformed. So we don't really see where discipline can take us. And ego is not really in control of the process either. I mean, there's almost a surrendering or a letting go of ego to allow that process to unfold. And certainly if I've had the experience at times, and I'm sure others have, that when we're in discipline, you know, at a certain point, something opens in meditation. And it's like, all right, well, now this is opening. I'm not going to turn this off now, you know. And we just have to ride out that process. The third metaphor I would use is the alchemical vase. The vase in which the alchemical transformation would take place. For example, the transformation of lead into gold. And incidentally, I think it's worthwhile saying, I mean, certainly there were shysters in the Middle Ages who, you know, walked around saying, you know, I have the secret to turn lead into gold, this sort of thing. The true alchemists were very clear on the fact. They would say, aurum nostri non est aurum vulgae. The gold that we're talking about is not what common people think of when they think of gold, you know. Alchemy was much more about a process of mystical transformation. But it was said that the vase was hermetically sealed. That is to say, sealed with the magic of the god Hermes. And this seal was absolute. And it would remain absolute until the transformation had taken place. And it was understood that if the vessel were not sealed in such an absolute way, the transformation wouldn't take place. That you wouldn't turn lead into gold or whatever. And this points to almost, you might say, a draconian side of discipline. That discipline is most potent when it has kind of an absolute or unbreakable quality to it. And, you know, I think it's funny. I think some people approach something like meditation with, I'll try this for a while, I'll dabble with it, and then see how it goes, you know. And I think what often happens is, once we get into it a little bit, then our issues start to get triggered. And when a deep issue is getting triggered, it can have a whole life impact. Like, suddenly, this issue is getting triggered in me. Suddenly I'm starting to have arguments and I don't understand why I'm having arguments. Things that seemed easy now are difficult. You know, I'm seeing challenges everywhere. I'm griping about everything. Like, the whole world is kind of rubbing me the wrong way, you know. And it's so easy at that moment to say, well, I'm dealing with so much else. Maybe I'll give up meditating for a while, you know. In other words, just when it's getting juicy is when we pull the plug. I remember a psychologist that I was talking to once, he was talking about the marriage vow in terms of the alchemical vase. He was a Jungian. And he said the reason that the traditional marriage vow was absolute, you know, for better, for worse, rich or poor, till death do us part, was so that each person could show the other, as it were, their ugliest face, you know? And because if the vow's not absolute, you know, I show my partner my ugliest face, they run away, you know, that sort of thing. And it's only when the vow is absolute that both partners can show their ugliest face and be seen. And in that being seen, that itself is healing. And similarly with meditation, you know, it's only when that vow is absolute that I can see my own ugliest face, that I can face my own ugliest demon, you know. I've certainly have had many, many days in my own practice when I go to sit down in the morning, it is the last thing in the world I want to do to sit on that cushion, you know. And often at this point, I've been through this cycle so many times, it's familiar, you know. Whenever I have that feeling, it's precisely because something so vulnerable opens up that morning, you know. And whether I want to or not, then I'm facing something else, you know, that sort of thing. And so it's natural for us, especially in this kind of undisciplined world, for the question to arise, how do I get more discipline? You know, and it's the paradoxical thing about discipline. We get more discipline by practicing discipline, you know. And it, you know, it's sort of one of those frustrating things, like the person who has money, they can invest it and make more money. You know, it's very similar. When you have discipline, then it allows you to get more discipline. And so starting out, you know, to some extent, we almost have to get in touch with, you might say, an inner drill sergeant or something, and just, you know, marshal our strength and do it. I think that's part of it, but I think part of it is also really having a very honest conversation with ourselves, you know? If I live a life of discipline, I'm putting myself on a track to open up my deeper possibilities, to be in touch with my higher self, you know? If I'm not going to live a life of discipline, in some sense, I'm choosing not to activate those possibilities, you know? What would it be to be on my deathbed knowing I walked away and left that on the table, you know? And I think that's the kind of honesty we have to have with ourselves, because in many ways that's what's at stake with living a life of discipline or not. And I think I would say also, this culture that we live in, this culture, this very undisciplined culture, is starved for people who live a disciplined life. Like, people who live with discipline have almost a superpower in this culture, you know? And just the way we live in our lives can be so nourishing to people. And this is always a profound aspect of practice. You know, my practice, my discipline does not belong to me. My practice or my discipline belongs to all souls. You know, and that casts a whole other level of you might say responsibility to it. So at this point, I'll hand out the quote sheet. First, I'll give it to the Zoomies. A run to the bathroom in the room.
School teachers, so I always have handouts.
Thank you. So the first few are from the Dhammapada. The Dhammapada is a central Buddhist text. How to say it? If you looked at the original Buddhist writings, the Triptika, it would fill a small bookshelf, and of course every sutra begins with the Buddha said, and if the Buddha said all of this stuff, he would have lived like 5,000 years. But scholars feel that the Dhammapada in some ways might be, as it were, a compilation of like the words of the actual historical Buddha. So from the Dhammapada we have, the immature lose their vigilance, but the wise guard it as their greatest treasure. Another one, more than your mother, more than your father, more than all your family, a well-disciplined mind does greater good. And it's not written here, but then the consequence is an ill-disciplined mind does more harm than your worst enemy, you know, that kind of thing. As irrigators lead water where they want, as archers make their arrows straight, as carpenters carve wood, the wise shape their mind. And finally, one who conquers himself is greater than another who conquers 1,000 times 1,000 men on the battlefield. Of course, it'd be a neat trick to conquer 1,000,000 men all by yourself on the battlefield, but at any rate. Thucydides said, self-control is the chief element in self-respect, and self-respect is the chief element in courage. It's a fascinating set of connections there.
Do you know when he said it?
No, I don't know where Thucydides said that. Sorry. I just found that quote.
He wrote about Peloponnesian War.
Yes, yes. Yes, he did write about the Peloponnesian Wars. Absolutely. Aristotle said, "We are what we repeatedly do. Excellence, then, is not an act, but a habit." That one is actually very deep. Rumi said, "Be passionate for the friend's tyranny, not his tenderness, so the arrogant beauty in you can become a lover that weeps." You know, and can we really look at the arrogant beauty in us? John Locke says, "The discipline of desire is the background of character." Prime Minister Benjamin Disraeli said, "The secret of success is constancy of purpose." Field Marshal Montgomery said, "Discipline strengthens the mind so that it becomes impervious to the corroding influence of fear." And fear is really the enemy of everything that is great within us. Muhammad Ali Jinnah, the first president of Pakistan, said, "With faith, discipline, and selfless devotion to duty, there's nothing worthwhile that you cannot achieve." President Harry Truman said, "In reading the lives of great men, I found that the first victory they won was over themselves. Self-discipline with all of them, came first." William Feather said, "If we do not discipline ourselves, the world will do it for us." There's something very sobering about that. Helen Keller said, "One painful duty fulfilled makes the next plainer and easier." And again, this whole thing about the more we practice discipline, the easier it is to practice discipline. Napoleon Hill said, "If you do not conquer yourself, you will be conquered by self." Wow. Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel said, "Self-respect is the fruit of discipline. The sense of dignity grows with the ability to say no to oneself." You know, and that's powerful. Do we have a healthy yes, and do we have a healthy no, not only to others, but also to ourselves? Coach Vince Lombardi said, "It's easy to have faith in yourself and discipline when you're a winner, when you're number one. What you've got to have is faith and discipline when you're not a winner." Nelson Mandela said, "Running taught me valuable lessons. In cross-country competitions, training counted more than intrinsic ability, and I could compensate for lack of natural aptitude with diligence and discipline. I applied this in everything I did." Wow. Zig Ziglar said, "It's absolutely true that unless you can instill discipline upon yourself, you'll never be able to lead others." Barbara Ann Scott said, "Those edges and turns teach control and discipline, like the finger exercises on a piano." And that one just reminds me of, it actually reminds me of the pianist Rachmaninoff. Rachmaninoff was during his lifetime, he was considered the greatest pianist alive. He also was a composer. Every single day, he would practice for hours and hours. And he would start, the first couple of hours would just be nothing but scales. The simplest thing that you would teach a child. And he'd do all kinds of, you know, scales, you know, one hand, two hand, one against, you know, two against three rhythms, you know, every variation on scales, but just scales, you know. The basics every single day. That's discipline. Martin Luther King Jr. said, "The time is always right to do what is right." You know, as opposed to, you know, all the thousands of excuses we give about, well, I know this would be right, but, you know. The Dalai Lama said, "Whether you call it Buddhism or another religion, self-discipline, that's important. Self-discipline with awareness of consequences." The poet David White said, "And that one of the great disciplines of existence is just to stay up with the frontier of your own maturation. To have said goodbye to what you need to say goodbye to, and to be saying hello to what you should be saying hello to. But caught in the enmeshment of the strategic mind, which coalesces its identity around false stories and holds on to them, quite often we're a good 6 or 7 years behind where we actually are. Daniel Goldstein said, I think self-discipline is something. It's like a muscle. The more you exercise it, the stronger it gets. Anthony Joshua said, as long as you have discipline, you can be a success. Discipline is what makes you do everything you need to do. And Race Mamenikin says, self-discipline is self-love. Show me a person who is not disciplined, and I will show you a person who doesn't love themselves. Mm-hmm.